Thank you.
Mr. Goulet, yes. And I think I'm just going to tweak the order a little bit. We'll have Mr. Goulet and then Mr. Carr. Just due to comment that Mr. Luker should say at the end, I'll just get the witnesses on here and then use the Goulet and Mr. Carr.
You just call Mr. Goulet short and sweet.
My name is Kenneth Frank Freemate. My evidence and sheets date of 4 April 2017 outlines my experience and qualifications for evidence for evidence in respect to the upper truth of mapping hearings. The conclusions are, there is adequate infrastructure planned and consented to serve the Glendrew Bay development as proposed in the Glendrew Bay Trustees Limited submission seeking a new Glendrew station zone on the district paper. I have reviewed the current plans, consents and design for water supply, wastewater, stormwater, power supply and telecommunications infrastructure to serve the Glendrew Bay development, and I am satisfied that this work is sufficiently advanced to be confident that adequate infrastructure will be available for the development as proposed in the structure plan. I have reviewed the rebuttal evidence of Holbrook replacement on behalf of Queenstown Lakes District Council with respect to the Glendrew Bay Trustees submission, and I have no further comment.
Paragraph 13 of your evidence in chief refer to a minor variation of LRC consent. What's the nature of the variation?
Campground extension was not part of the original consents from the Total Regional Council for wastewater for water supply.
So it's the purpose of the consent rather than anything to do with the volume of water?
But it would be volume. Yes. It would be great demand.
It would.
But it's not a great increment demand, and I'm confident that the land area for wastewater and the water supply that's already been tested, the pool that's been tested, would have the capacity to supply additional demand.
So what sort of percentage are you talking about? So is it 10% more, 50% more?
In that order.
10% more?
I haven't calculated it, but I expect that.
Put it right here. Accepting that engineers never hate to do that.
I'm familiar with the...
What order of what magnitude are we talking about?
I'm assuming that we don't have a development proposal for the campground, but my planning or my thoughts are around the demand of the existing Glendrew Bay campground, which has a population over the summer period of about 2,000 people. And on that basis, I'm confident that demand for that number of people would be met from the existing water supply and the potential for expanded wastewater treatment.
So you're looking at that enough water for sort of service 2,000 people?
Quite a lot.
And for paragraph 21, you draw a distinction between home sites and the pool development. We have confirmation from Aurora and Chorus about the home sites, and they've been consulted regarding the balance, which leaves it hanging. What are they saying? Is it an issue, isn't it? Will they put it on paper?
Firstly, Aurora Energy has put it on paper. I'm just reading this again to see if I've actually made a mistake in it. The August 2016 letters related to the home sites, but both Aurora Energy and Chorus Network Services were advised of the total development at that time. I have since received a letter from Aurora Energy, my request, specifically covering a development as currently proposed, which includes the 50 home sites. And I have that with me if you wish me to table it.
Well, just tell me what it says.
It says there's no problem.
That's good enough. So that's Aurora say there's no issue for the whole development. And what if anything at Chorus say?
Chorus, there were letters back in the mid-2000s when the consent was first sought, and they had everything except for the golf, for the campground. At that time they advised they had capacity. Now those capacity statements can vary. Their situation might change. Certainly hasn't for Aurora. And telecommunications has become less and less of an essential service.
The letterboxes.
Yeah. Well, it can be other means of getting data in and like wires up the road.
One question, the water supply, I presume it's going to be chlorine, is it?
Because it's taken from the bore in the ground, it was proposed to be filtered and treated with UV and not chlorinated. Now that does depend on the standards at the time, because they're not fixed, they do evolve. And also on the preference of the residents. But it has to comply with the drinking water standards. Just as councils do.
That's everything. You good?
Good, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Right, and what's the car?
The Mayor, Mr. Chief, I described the road and network in the vicinity of the site, noting that the only road and link between the site and Wanaka is Wanaka Mount Squire Road, which is a collector road in the Queenstown Lakes District on roading hierarchy. I outlined that the road typically carries around 1,200 vehicles per day, but that this increases to around 2,400 vehicles per day at peak times, which equates to peak hour traffic flow of 180 vehicles per hour in the shoulder season, and 360 vehicles per hour in the busiest summer and winter periods. I reviewed the crash records for the road and set out that on the basis of my assessment, I did not agree with Ms. Spence's opinion that the road was a black spot for vehicle crashes. It appears Ms. Spence had concurred with my views regarding the current situation, notwithstanding her concerns of future changes arising from increased traffic flows. Also in my evidence in chief, I evaluated the likely changes on the road network due to increased levels of development within the site. I noted that this analysis was done at a high level because the submission anticipates that increased development will be a restricted discretionary activity, with one of the matters of discretion being traffic generation, access and car parking. In other words, those activities requiring consent must have their traffic effects assessed and evaluated at the time the application is made. Ms. Banks expressed some concern about this approach because she considered that the uncertainty about what developments might occur means that the extent of the traffic generation might be higher than I'd assess. I accept that it's not possible to be prescriptive about the extent of development that might occur and hence the resultant traffic flows, but I consider that the safety and efficiency of the road network is protected under this situation because the activity or activities will require resource consent with the traffic effects being assessed at the time. If the effects are unacceptable and unable to be mitigated, then the council is able to decline the application. Conversely, if the extent of development is fully known, as the council seems to see, then I agree that the traffic generation can be derived more accurately and the effects on the road network identified and assessed in some detail. However, under this scenario, if the effects are acceptable, then there's little purpose to provide the rule of restricting discretion for traffic-related effects, since this simply requires an identical traffic assessment in the future when an application is made. In my experience, if the scale and, or nature of the scale of effects are known at the outset and unlikely to change in the future environment, then there's no need to reserve discretion over that matter. Notwithstanding this, I think we've got provided with a hypothetical development scenario in order to assist in understanding the likely scale of generated traffic volumes. In my evidence in chief, I listed the following as being the consented development: golf course and clubhouse, boat jetty, 12 visitor accommodation units and 42 residential visitor accommodation units. I noted that these would give rise to an additional 90 vehicle movements per hour, two-way at peak times. The scenario which I've been provided anticipates the following theoretical mix of additional small-scale developments, so that is, beyond the existing residential and farming activities that could occur in the GSF, GSC and GSFH activity areas. That's two additional residences, 50 campground-style visitor accommodation units, 12 farm-scale units, an events venue of 500 square metres, a brochure and abattoir of 500 square metres, a tannery of 200 square metres, a cafe of 200 square metres, and a craft brewery of 200 square metres. I have also allowed for a doubling of the number of campers in the activity area. In practice, the activities that will generate traffic on one of the most aspiring roads are the residential and visitor accommodation units, the events venue, and the campground. Although the other activities might generate some low levels of traffic, I understand that these are intended to serve and be complementary to the existing and proposed campground accommodation and proposed house site developments, rather than being a destination in their own right that would attract or generate vehicles from further afield. In this regard, I consider that the site is sufficiently distant from the main Wanaka town centre such that any small-scale commercial activities would not attract significant additional traffic movements. With regard to the total of 62 campground accommodation units and two residences, I'm allowed for each unit to generate one vehicle movement in the peak hours. For this to be the case, each unit will need to be occupied, and all occupants must decide to travel within the same 60-minute period. My evidence in chief, I noted that the location of the site meant that the latter was very unlikely. It's also evident that due to the seasonal nature of the campgrounds, not all units will be occupied continuously. Consequently, in my view, allowing for 64 vehicle movements in the peak hour is a robust assumption. The attendance at an event venue will be limited by its size of 500 square metres. Although the maximum person capacity of the venue is not known, I've recently been involved in another commission where a venue of 300 square metres was expected to accommodate a maximum of 120 guests. On this basis, then, a venue of this size could accommodate 200 guests. It's commonly accepted that at such events there is a high degree of car sharing and taxi use. Allowing for 2.5 people per vehicle means that a maximum of 80 vehicle movements into the venue and 80 vehicle movements out of the venue would arise. The calculation of traffic volumes arising from the events venue anticipates the maximum number of attendees and that there will be one such event very frequently. Again, these are robust assumptions. Regarding the increase in the size of the campground, as I set out above, the busiest times of the year, the traffic flows increase from 180 to 360 vehicles per hour. so allowing for a doubling of the campground and a consequential doubling of the traffic flows, then a further 180 vehicles per hour could arise on one commercial spiring road in the peak season. In terms of the timing of traffic movements, I consider that the greatest effect would arise in the evening. This will be when residents and visitors return home, so that would be 64 movements westbound. An event starts, further 80 vehicle movements westbound, and then making a further allowance for the campground of 180 vehicle movements means that there will be a maximum increase of 324 vehicle movements per hour on one commercial spiring road in the peak season. However, I expect that the expanded campground will have the same travel characteristics as the existing campground, meaning that the traffic generation will be greatly reduced in the shoulder seasons. At this time, I expect that the increase in the traffic flows will be 144 vehicle movements and associated with the residential visitor accommodation unit and the events venue. The Crossroads Guide to Traffic Management Part 3 sets out a methodology whereby the level of service provided by a road can be found. I set out in my evidence in chief that using this and allowing for the consented development, one can mount a spiring road currently provides level of service C in the shoulder season and level of service D in the busiest seasons. Level of service C is noted in the Crossroads Guide as a zone of stable flow, but where most drivers are restricted to some extent in their freedom to select their desired speed and to manoeuvre within the traffic stream. Level of service D is close to the limit of stable flow, where all drivers are severely restricted in their freedom to select their desired speed and to manoeuvre within the traffic stream. Allowing for a further 324 vehicle movements in the peak hours in the peak season means that the level of service in one amount of spiring road would remain at level of service D. Further, allowing for 144 vehicle movements in the peak hours in the shoulder season, it means that the level of service in one amount of spiring road would remain at level of service C. That is, the increased traffic volumes do not lead to any change in the current levels of service. I stress that such a development, and I have noted above, could not occur without applying for consent, since it will be a restricted discretionary activity, and the associated development-specific traffic assessment will be required at that time. However, in my opinion, this theoretical example demonstrates that there is ample capacity on one commercial spiring road to accommodate additional traffic. In my evidence in chief, I noted that any increase in traffic volumes would proportionally increase the risk of crashes. As banks notes that in light of this, and due to compromised sight distances for drivers from one commercial spiring road, she has concerns about road safety due to greater numbers of vehicles. In the first instance, it's worth noting that the relationship between traffic flows and crashes is common to every single road and intersection in New Zealand. It is not unique to one commercial spiring road. That said, I acknowledge that it's important to ensure that before increasing traffic flows in any location, an evaluation is required of the crash record to ensure that any clusters of accidents will not be exacerbated by the increase. For this reason, in my evidence in chief, I calculated the expected crash rate of one commercial spiring road and found that it was better than average. I also identified that there were no clusters of crashes evident. It is also worth highlighting that the distinction between crash risk per person, and the absolute number of crashes. An increase in the traffic flow increases the absolute number of crashes, but the risk per person stays the same. In other words, the road has not somehow become more risky for travellers, but rather the number of crashes is simply a function of the traffic volume having increased. Accordingly, I consider that the injury accident rate on one commercial spiring road will remain at or below the typical rate for roads of this nature, even with higher traffic flows, since there's no evidence of any inherent safety-related deficiency. On this basis, I remain of the view that road safety will not be compromised by an increased level of traffic. Because of its location, visitors to Wanaka can only have approached the town using the Crown Range Road, State Highway 6, the Waikoloa Highway, or State Highway 6, the Albert Town Lake Highway Road. While I've not undertaken an in-depth assessment of the vertical and horizontal alignments of Wanaka Master Spiring Road, I've driven the route several times, and in my view the alignment is far better than the Crown Range Road and the Albert Town Lake Highway Road, and it's comparable to the Wanaka Lake Highway. When compared to these routes, I do not consider that the road will be particularly difficult or intrinsically unsafe to drive. So in conclusion, having reviewed Ms. Francis' rebuttal evidence, I remain with the overall view expressed by Owners in Chief and continue to support the submission of Glenview Bay Trustees Limited for the rezoning as sought as it relates to traffic effects. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Carr, in terms of the scenario that you seized, and that's helpful, thank you, can you give me any assistance as to where on the spectrum between best case, worst case scenario that is?
I guess the test of best or worst is in this particular case a little artificial because of the restricted discretionary activity that's being sought. Whether it's best case or worst case or a high level of traffic or low level of traffic, it's still subject to the need for a traffic assessment at the time. So if the development was to be more intense, then traffic effects would be arguably greater, but would still be assessed at the time. I think the doubling of the campground is probably where at the top. Mr. Guillemot said there were 2,000 people there at peak times. Doubling the size of the campground would suggest 4,000 people. That in turn would suggest that there's a huge pent-up demand potentially in Wanaka. I have no evidence to say that one thing or another, but it's unusual, in my view, to see such a step change with any sort of development. And the assessment of the houses and visitor accommodation units and the event centre all assume that everything is working at maximum capacity and is everyone's travelling at the same time. So to that extent, the scenario that I assess has got the worst case scenario on that particular scenario. Isn't to say that that scenario is the worst case in totality that could occur.
But in your view, it's closer to the worst case than the best case.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Part of your methodology is you try to predict the spread of traffic given that you have daily figures.
Yes.
And the proposition I want, and you said effectively this is not a commuter.
Yes.
This is not a commuter traffic flow that you can say it, and it can, Commissioner Hudson has been bemoaning to say that Auckland traffic between the North Shore and Auckland Airport to be, it's not in that category, in the sense of a predictable pattern. The question I have is that midwinter, when you'd assume that the vast majority of cars on the road are heading towards Triple Cone, would that be an exception? Because most people are going to want to be on the mountain by 9 a.m. and they're all going to be coming off the mountain at the same time.
Yeah, I think taking one step back, the council got counts for a number of times in the year. It has the shoulder season, it has a count in early January, which is where the 2,400 comes from. They also have counts when the ski season is operating, and the 2,400 is the peak at any time, so even when ski season will swing, the traffic volumes don't get up to the levels that you see when the campground is generating a large amount of traffic. So we're starting at a baseline that's lower than the peak that you see. There will be a short-term lift in the traffic, if you like. It happens at every ski field and the ski field closes. The generally what you see from a field traffic count point of view is that there's a general busy period for a couple of hours in the morning, but then it's really busy for half an hour in the afternoon as everybody leaves. It's the same at every ski trip, and it's just the nature of the ski field traffic. So over the course of the day, I wouldn't expect that there will be any effect whatsoever. In the short period of time in the afternoon, the road will become busier, but the levels of traffic, certainly recorded by the council, have suggested that it's lower than what happens at the summer period.
You said it's still lower than the peak, daily peak.
Daily, yeah.
Do we have, I suppose it, the question is there a risk that in midwinter the instantaneous peak will be materially higher than that which you've assumed?
I don't think so. If everyone's coming off the ski field and they're heading into this development, this development does not have a large amount of accommodation. So you're talking of 64, I think, units, two residential, 62 VA units. So the rest of that traffic is going to be heading into visitor accommodation within one. The traffic generation of the events centre, events venue, function venue in the site would all be heading in the opposite direction, be heading westbound. And if all of the people coming off, or if all of the visitor accommodation units were used by skiers, then there would be no one who was heading from Wanaka out to that visitor accommodation. That's there. So there's a beneficial cumulative effect, if you like, by reducing, well, reducing the amount of westbound traffic at that time if the ski area is really busy. But the effects of this development, over and above what happens as a result of the ski field, will be, I was going to say minuscule, but that's a pretty loose term. I don't think that they will be noticeable within the general traffic stream. It's a small development that we're talking of here, and that would be reduced even further if the skiers were staying at the visitor accommodation that would be provided.
I wonder, the last one, I'm wondering if you could assist me, that Ms. Hilger has produced a BOFA's resource report from 2006 that did predict a change in traffic service, and so I'm effectively, I'm wondering why BOFA's came to a different conclusion that you are now telling us about. Are you able to assist me?
I haven't seen that that scenario. So there's a number of reasons that it could be. I mean, I can only talk generically about that, so I haven't had a chance to look at it. But
well, don't speculate. If you haven't read it, I'll just give Ms. Galloway the reference. So hopefully, between their team, we can provide some enlightenment. It's at page 25. The conclusion, a reduction in level of service could be anticipated in winter when considering the cumulative effect of traffic additional to that generated by travel park. So, but I'll just invite Ms. Baker Galloway to ponder that. Commissioner Hudson, any questions for Mr. McCarr? Okay.
Mr. Carr, the first question I had is, in talking about the level of service, you projected that the level of service would be C or D. Is level of service D acceptable, in your opinion, in sort of locality?
Yes, it is. On rural roads, the levels of service are different to how they are on urban roads. The concept of level of service blocks traffic flow. So typically, if you have a road with up to 100 or 200, 300 vehicles per day, then it begins level of service A. Level of service B kind of kicks in a little bit after that. So the lower and upper bounds of the level of service are relatively wide, and they get wider as the level of service diminishes. So a level of service D at peak times, assuming a worst case scenario, is in my view acceptable, because it is based upon a worst case scenario and the highest traffic flows that occur any time during the year.
Right, thank you. Now, going back to your paragraph 13 of your summary statement that you've read today, you've based your assessment based on a scenario that you've been given. What I'm not clear about is you've listed under D through to H a number of different activities with four areas, but looking at Mr. Ferguson's supplementary statement and revised zone provisions, I can't quite align these with what is provided for, and I'm not sure whether you would have had an opportunity to see Mr. Ferguson's revised provisions. So the first question is, have you?
I've briefly had a look at them, but this scenario was discussed amongst the team and felt an appropriate basis to look at. But again, even with this scenario, this is not as of right, this is all requiring that traffic assessment before it got to that point. So to some extent, even if greater development was contemplated within the zoning provisions, there's still the need for that traffic assessment.
Yes. So in particular, there is provision in the zone provision, and I was going to ask Mr. Ferguson about this later, for up to 300. The rule provides for a maximum of 500 square metres of retail. And I haven't managed to sort of align what you've outlined here with 500 square metres of retail. I wouldn't have thought that butcher and abattoir that comprises both processing and retail would be considered as full retail activity, but on the other hand, a cafe of 200 square metres might, one potential scenario would be cafe with a local craft slash gift shop of some sort or locally based artisan type products or honey something, you know. So if we were looking at a total of 500 square metres of that sort of retail, would that, in your opinion, change the basis on which you've reached your conclusion about the overall cabinet generation?
No, because the site is sufficiently distant from the town centre that, in my view, there would be very few people that would specifically go to that cafe. Purely because there's so much of an opportunity that's close and more convenient. So
you don't see it as a destination cafe?
No. Okay. Even if it was a destination cafe, I mean, my analysis is based upon a scenario in the evening, which would be when the event centre is starting and people are returning home. That's not necessarily the time when people would be going to a cafe. The cafe is generally sort of peak times on a Saturday and Sunday in the middle of the day. So even if it was remote, it could be some sort of destination, but the traffic flows would not be generated at the same time as the peak, so I assume they would still be lower.
Paragraph 14, we've commented on allowing for doubling of the number of campers in the Canterbury activity area. Now, again, you made an assumption that we're talking campus, but one of the things that, again, a question that will follow from Mr. Ferguson is that a campground may not necessarily be all campus mat. Would you have factored in people that are staying there for slightly longer term than campus, people in cabins or that are perhaps workers staying there on a semi-permanent basis?
So I think that it would be reasonable to allow for the expanded or increased size of the campground to have the same characteristics as the existing campground. So if there are workers in the future in this location, it would be reasonable to say that there's workers there now. If there's people who are staying there for a longer period of time for other reasons, again, it would be reasonable to say that they are staying there now as well. So that's a step change of us doubling the existing characteristics of the campground. I don't see that the size of the campground per se necessarily changes the characteristics of the people who stay there. If there were more permanent units, that might be the trick, but that's taken into account within the market anyway.
Well, yes, I don't want to take that much further because I expect that to depend on the actual activity. And this is getting down to those specifics.
The other thing to highlight though is that this 2,400, this additional 1,200 from the building campground is still at the peak times. So if we're talking shoulder season where perhaps there would be, arguably, there may be more workers staying there. There are far fewer tourists that are staying there, so again, that increase that I've allowed for would be reduced under that circumstance.
Well, what a realistic scenario would be in that shoe season, for example, having field workers staying there and developing and generating habitats that are more in the nature of the commuter sector than they're living there. Temporary residents going to work.
If that was the case, then that would, to be comparable, that would require 1,200 workers to be travelling from the campground to the ski field. The ski field does generate workers, but it's a lot less than that in terms of quantum. So again, I'm confident that the 1,200 is a robust upper scenario, and that other scenarios throughout the year would be diminished from that.
Thank you. Now, paragraph 16, you referred to a total of 62 campground accommodation units, and I wasn't sure whether you actually meant campground accommodation units or whether that was the proposed 50 residences and 12 visitor accommodation units provided for.
Yeah, it's the 50 units that are mentioned in 13B. Plus the 12 units that are mentioned in 13C.
So that's not the campground.
It's the campground for campground style, I suppose.
Well, can you just explain then what your understanding was of the campground style visitor accommodation units? Because I have no idea, unless you're referring to the residences that are within the residential activity area. I don't know where this campground accommodation unit number has come from. Yes, I understand the 12, but I don't know where the other 50 has come from.
Well, that might be better directed to Mr. Ferguson, because this is a scenario that has been provided to me rather than one of the developing.
All right, thank you. And paragraph 22 is referred to the expanded campground having the same travel characteristics as the existing one. Did you have any survey data relating to the existing traffic characteristics of the existing campground, or was that based on the total level of usage during the summer and typical
Yeah, the council has traffic counts for Wanaka Mountain Spiring Road between the campsite and the town. And that shows in the shoal season, 1,200.
So that's based on the council's pivot.
And then the first week of January, 2,400.
Thank you. That's all I have.
It's not a very brief synopsis would be that the amount of traffic generated is generally insignificant to the effect on the road.
Yeah. I wouldn't get paid if I wrote that in my evidence, so I have to write more
work. That's very honest of you, on record as well. One question, just with regard to the capping and the bits and pieces not being a destination unit, and I get in the overall grand scheme of things that's probably not going to be a significant factor, but if I was sitting in a accommodation unit in Warwick, I think I can go for a cafe, or I can go for a beautiful drive to a stunning vista which has got a craft beer works and a cafe and a tannery, and I'd actually say, well, you know what, I'll take that drive. Because I come from Sydney and I can now drive down a Class C road, because I know it's a Class C road now, I can drive it. So I would actually be attracted to go there. And obviously, just when you say it would not attract significant additional traffic, there's no such in the grand scheme of things. I think in that particular assessment might be a bit.
Well, as I said before, I think what could be slightly facetious, you might want to visit the brewery where you don't have one drink before you're at the limit. So.
But I have my partner who's with me, who doesn't drink.
Very understanding partner.
Yeah. there is a cost to be paid for that.
there's a synergy, even if it was to be. The scenario that I most often refer to is, let's say, Jamie Oliver deciding to set up his new place there in the cafe, and people wanted to purely to go to Jamie's new cafe.
Yes. That was Rick Stein, I'd be there.
Firstly, the traffic generation happens at different times. It happens on a Sunday lunchtime, a Saturday lunchtime. This isn't when the people are returning home or there's an event which is starting at the function centre. So it's happening at a time when the ability of the road to absorb that traffic is greater. There will be an increase in the evening as people are going out for the evening meal. That might correspond to the scenario that I've assessed. But for that to have an effect, it would mean that everybody who's in the visitor accommodation unit would be travelling at the same time as everybody who's in the campground at the same time as the maximum event is happening. But that's an unlikely scenario. I hesitate to use the word perfect storm, because I've used that in a different hearing, but it would be a perfect storm of everything happening at the same time, onto which you're loading more traffic. Mm-hmm. But even in that circumstance, the amount of traffic is limited by the size of the cafe. So it's not like anybody would turn up there and hope they could get a table. That's the sort of place that you would book. And in that regard, it then starts to naturally diminish the amount of traffic that's there. So even if you were to say, well, there's 30 tables, everybody's travelling by car, that's 30 extra cars, wouldn't have any material effect on the amount of traffic.
Yeah. Much the same as the staff who actually, Glenview Bay Campground was staff accommodation for Trevor Gold for about 3 years. Had an impact. Yep, that's fine for me, thank you, sir.
One last question, Pat. Your paragraph 6, you're quoting the matter of stretching traffic generation access and car parking. I wonder if that is sufficiently broad. Traffic generation managing its source, whether some other form of words would better capture which you see in effect. Can you suggest to me an alternative that would capture the range of traffic effects that might need to be managed? Because it's not all, I don't think it's all traffic generation.
Yeah, I think it is, I suppose it depends on how you read it, but I certainly would read traffic generation as being quite a wide term. that would capture it. But if he was to drill down to it, I would make it specific to the effects of traffic generation on the peak hour flows on quite an inspiring road. But that seems to be the concern of the council consultant engineer. That's the scenario that I've assessed, so it would be reasonable if you were minded to change that to make it specific in that way. Ultimately, it was still, in my mind, if I was involved in assessing it, I was still doing the same work in the same way. So the phrasing condition actually wouldn't, in my view, change any information that was required or would be provided by.
Yes, but if I change the scope of the conditions, possibly, but if it's not expressed broadly enough.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Anything else, any more questions? Very good. Thank you, Mr. Carr. Thank you for your contribution.
Put Mr. Carr out of misery in terms of that appendix, the resource study, I think it's misleading evidence. It, to be clear, what that study was pre-consent application was not in respect of any particular scenario. It was looking at defining and explaining what the resources were and what the potential constraints were to inform the development and proposal that should then be assessed. So
yeah.
That would explain the, you know, the openness of the wording from the traffic design group report that simply flags that matter, you know, that more detailed investigations be carried out in respect of a specific land use proposal, which such a thing that was not.
Yes, I think what took my eye was that wasn't how it was framed. It was an assessment, but there was a particular level of effect from whatever assumptions lay behind it.
Yes, no, I think because it wasn't a proposal that was being assessed. I'm just in the phrasing, as you say.
Thank you for that. We have Mr. Thompson now.
Yes, we do.
Picking up on the conversation about vegetation, revegetation / regeneration this morning, if you've got Mr. Thompson's evidence in chief as well handy. And look at his appendix one. Which is the master plan is spent as approved. One point just to clarify in terms of the vegetation as it relates to the house site. The master plan and therefore the vegetation that's required under the consent was the scale of vegetation required for the original concept of 50 house sites. And that was never altered despite eight dropping off at the council stage. And so that is still the vegetation that's to be planted in accordance with the consent. And as I flagged, Ms. Fluger will assess, we are confirmed to you the effect of that requirement for vegetation and the additional eight sites in terms of how they're mitigated. But the other thing that Mr. Thompson will be able to take you through as it relates to the alteration of the golf course activity area is what that means for where the golf course has moved away from, because it's proposed to go into a different area, and therefore what the vegetation potential is for that golf course means, if you like.
Suffice it to say that one of my questions was going to be, if he's gaining three holes in the fern burn, where he's losing it from.
Mm.
So if I can expand on that.
Yeah. So when you get back to the evidence, I'll ask him to expand on that.
Paragraph 3.
Hardy's Bay Master Plan slash golf course. A few queries in relation to the southern tributary and marine slope landscape protection area, as it was called in submission, have arisen in Marion Reeves evidence paragraph 3.2 brackets H that need clarifying. Dr. Reed was concerned about the removal of a small area of the marine slope, whereas in fact this reflects a mapping area which incorrectly had a steep moraine slope escarpment extending out onto the old river terraces that it grazed. The area was identified by Valley Department in the process of an on-ground investigation as part of detailed golf course design work and consent implementation. I pass you Mr. Ferguson's evidence of a structure plan that illustrates the boundary of the moraine slope, now labelled as part of the farm and vegetation management area. Dr. Red also points out in paragraph 3.3 that the G-activity area has been extended out into this area which was previously OSF. She goes on to state that, and I quote, "It was seen from a topographical perspective to be unlikely to contribute to the further expansion of the golf course. In paragraph 29, my evidence, I qualify why utilising this area as a benefit to the golf experience, and that landscape variety is a key attribute of site selection as it leads to a high degree of memorability for the golfer. To realise the full benefits of the Parking Bay development, it is intended to be a marquee course and a must-play for the golf tourist list. This informed and rapidly growing market seeks out the best courses in the world to play, that is relying on integration of attractive and memorable environmental features to deliver a truly New Zealand golf experience. Playing in and around Fernburn would be a wonderful addition to the golf course quality, and for that reason the inclusion of that area in the revised OSF area has been deliberately pursued." If I can just expand upon, as you alluded to there, the addition of the three golf holes. The area where we're looking at losing some of the golf holes is around the lake edge, so just adjacent to the alleys here on the bottom map there, which is Appendix 2 and Chris Ferguson's supplementary evidence. And that area there, and also down by the mouth of the Fernburn as it exits out into Parkins Bay.
So on this master plan map, what's marked as the 12th and the 8th?
The Appendix 1? Yeah. So yes, basically, in the view, you just take 18, that moves pretty much back in between 16 and 15. And a consequence of that is also the opportunity there for more public access and potential revegetation of those lake areas, lake margin. The other area we're looking at is up the Fernburn on the south side of the Wanaka Spine Road, where we're looking at potentially bringing in two golf holes. One of those three is actually already approved in the Environment Court this morning. As part of that, we're looking at some riparian revegetation up there, should we be allowed to proceed with putting those two golf holes in. I'll return to my summary. Paragraph 6. Hardings Bay Master Plan, Home Site Design. CBTL has reviewed its design and developed a comprehensive set of planning provisions, now including a set of design controls, that hand in hand with existing covenants will continue to ensure an integrated outcome. Further to Dr. Reed's evidence in paragraph 3.6, she refers to, and I quote, "a coherent and consistent character as being preferable for a development of its nature." I'd agree with her comment, but that doesn't mean that all have to be identical. Amenity-related coherence is not reliant on built form homogeneity, otherwise the 1950s state housing precinct would conceivably exhibit a desirable character and amenity. The key criteria to establishing coherence for a built environment is to control certain design elements. In my experience, if you control four key elements, which have the greatest visual impact being height of the building, roof pitch, exterior cladding, and most importantly, landscape, then the level of coherence will result. Design controls are reflected in Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence. As identified in paragraph 5 above, the success of the Parkins Bay development is reliant on a high-quality golfing experience. That outcome will clearly be jeopardised by allowing an unattractive collection of disparate buildings to be established. For this reason, GDPR is comfortable including building design considerations in its revised rule set to ensure that the concerns of Dr. Reed are addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. Initial question from me. You know, four key elements. I can understand height, I can understand cladding, I understand landscaping, roof pitch. Which way around is it? Is a high roof pitch more obvious or and a flat roof less, and or the reverse?
It's a flat roof pitch obviously has a limited impact, which is, I sort of alluded to that, making a point there. That pitch roof obviously stands out a lot greater than that. Which is why the roof pitches obviously, this particular proposal, are all flat.
Identify these for me. Just trying to get my bearings here.
Yep.
I'm looking at Appendix 1. There's reference to a maintenance maintenance area.
Yes.
And that has apparently changed. As I just looking at this, I look at Appendix 1. It looks like the maintenance area is to the immediate west of the driving range.
Correct, yep.
And where is it going to go to?
My understanding it hasn't changed.
So that's a good answer. I've got it in the right place and it hasn't changed.
Correct.
And presumably that would be like groundskeeper's equipment, a big shed for groundskeeper's equipment.
Correct.
And the light.
Yes. Trying to make it look like a farm building.
And have you actually finalised your revised golf course layout?
It's a work in progress at the moment. A lot of this relates to trying to get it as cost effective as possible without sort of stripping out the inherent qualities of making it memorable. So it's a difficult time for golf courses in the current environment. High rates, labour rates, commodity prices are all incredibly high. So we're just going through that exercise now in feasibility.
Let's just say that our guide on our site visit suggested that you had multiple options in play down on the third group.
Yes, there's a few options we're looking at. One involves crossing the third group, and the other one stays on the treated patch.
Basically, you're trying to save costs without losing the golf course quality.
Correct. That's the output.
And presumably that might involve a certain amount of inter-team headbanging.
There's always tension in that particular discussion.
Are you a green counter or the golf course up?
On the golf course target here.
The reason I asked you the maintenance set is that Ms. Volker said that something had been shifted to be located on what was formerly the maintenance compound. So I should ask her about that.
I think so, because from day one, the maintenance compound has always been identified in that location.
Right. So that was why I was confused. The altered
sorry, I'm just writing this down.
In terms of the LS area, it's got a different, it's obviously got a different shape. Is it enlarged? What are the comparable sizes? Can you tell me that?
I have to refer to.
Because I was just looking at it by eye. And because you've, Mr. Ferguson produces before and after, but they're not the same as, they're a different, they're a rounded shape compared to what's on the course master plan. And I'm trying to get a handle on what the respective areas are.
Yeah. You need to compare to the, it's also the covenant area, isn't it?
Well, I think what's on Appendix 1 would be the covenant area.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And the question, so the question is, how does that compare for size? It's obviously in a different place, and I understand that, but how does it compare for size with what's now proposed?
I'm not sure of the exact change, but I'm pretty sure it has increased in, sorry, I think it has increased in size. But I think the allocation of building GFA is identical.
We can confirm that.
Can you please do this?
Yep.
And that's 3,000 GFA. If I got that right? Right, so he'll have all those things, figures of those things.
Okay, just one question. Was your brief, when you were referring to buildings, up to address only building design in relation to the golf course? You doesn't go beyond that to other aspects of the zone?
No, it doesn't. I mean, right back when this, so I sort of started this project sort of 15 years ago. So when I was involved with the inspection, we were on the sort of design management role. And now it's effectively just on the golf course design side of the equation. But I was asking a comment on design control relating to the home sites for my evidence.
Well, that's what I really wanted to get to then. So your comments about the four key aspects do relate to the home sites as well,
correct,
to the golf course design.
Oh, no, they only relate to the home sites. Oh, sorry, you say that, yeah.
My reading of the Environment Court decision was that some wake, or in the court reaching its findings, one of the aspects that it commented on was the actual specific design of those residences. So going forward with the zone provisions, they do appear to open up the opportunity for a significant change in the design. My reading of the revised provisions that Mr. Ferguson put forward, for example, there's no requirement that the residences would have grass or turf roofs. So is that a correct interpretation of what is now in the provisional
design? Yeah, so it's my understanding there's a bit more flexibility in that. But it's my understanding the roofs are still flat, and whether they're grassed up or whether there's a gravel or schist cover on them, I think would be, from the point of view where you're viewing it from, there'd be limited effect because you're looking pretty much at all the houses from both the lake and also from the road.
What I don't see in the zone provisions is any reference to any consistency or coherence in the design of buildings across the zone. If it's your opinion that that is an important measure to be taken into account when development actually occurs?
Yeah, as I alluded to in my summary, you don't want homogeneity right across the board. The big distinguishing feature of Parkins Bay is the high level of revegetation integration into that sort of natural pattern. the vegetation here stands as the number one mitigating factor as well as the fact that the buildings are hunkered down into the landscape. So I think, at its fulfillment of the project and completion of all revegetation, it's going to be very hard to point out the dwellings. That was the whole intention from day one, was to integrate it so well that the home sites had view in the sun, looking out towards the north, but they were very not really visible from major viewpoints of the road or the lake.
What is the reason for wanting to change the design of the residences?
I think it's to give a bit more flexibility to future purchases. And I'm currently speaking for John's motivations of why this facility wants it. A bit more variety for producers to, I guess, customise their home. The original ones were all exactly the same footprint, and this is a bit more flexibility without creating any of this effect, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Nothing for me. Okay. In paragraph 44, Mr. Thompson, you ventured into the planner's realm talking about the appropriateness of controlled activity spouse. You've repeatedly emphasised the importance of open space. Therefore, the question that occurs to me is, do you think that council should have the ability to reject designs that it doesn't, the location of a building that doesn't provide the open space you've suggested is important?
Yes, when we were reviewing the master plan as part of the district plan review process, one of the questions which came up was access to the lakefront. At the moment, that's where we've currently got the clubhouse and the visitor accommodation. And one thing we've noticed while I was coming back to Queenstown for 2 years up in Auckland was just the level of visitors now in the area, and particularly also use of our local residents, the resident community has grown. So one of the views was that we could pull those particular amenities, the clubhouse and the visitor accommodation, away from that main beach area towards the east. That would enable more open space for public accessibility. There was a comment, I think it was during the council hearing, that some of the opposition were concerned about the privatising of that beach with the clubhouse and visitor accommodation. And we've seen how desirable that spot is over summertime with boats coming up there and parking on the beach having picnics. And one of the views was, if we could replan it, how would we do that? And one of the options we're looking at was to move the whole zone across to the east into the Gulf area.
And that's what you're now closer.
That's correct.
Thank you very much. Latecomer, and hopefully not embarrass myself. Surely not. In your editor-in-chief, you, in one point, paragraph 31, you spend a lot of detail into seeing how it was the original master plan for the 50 Hill sites was the most rigorous undertaking in your, and I think it was 22 years. Does that not attest to some, obviously it does attest to the sensitivity of the site, which goes on to, you know, when you look at the fact that even though the consented dwellings were all recessed, set back, eight of them were declined consent by council, and these are the eight that we end up being discussing now. So within all that environment, and the Environment Court decided that consenting is the way forward versus the zone, surely that would, does that point towards the zone being inappropriate, or am I just missing the mark?
I think the zone is inappropriate. I think one of the things we find is, and I think already predated my getting back involved in the project, was little things like, you know, moving a golf hole required variation to the resource consent, and that becomes unworkable at a certain point. We're always asking for little changes of, you know, almost with the minimum effect, basically. I think when it comes to, you know, I concur, you know, it was the most rigorous undertaking from us that I've ever been involved in. What we're seeing now is we just like, I think, some more flexibility as to how we can undertake it. Some adjustments to building dimension, materials, like shadow concrete versus rammed earth, any little change requires a variation of consent. And I think these zones are going to enable a bit more flexibility within that to enable better outcomes.
And at what point is there too much flexibility? That's the line, obviously. And also interesting to note that in further on, you're going to say that the growth rates of the Kānuka quite surprised you in that they were achievable and the mitigation measures were appropriate and effective. Does that reflect on the staging at all, or?
No, I think the staging was one of those things. I think it sort of got away of itself a little bit. It started off as a sequence of events which would occur, and then became the mandated, this is what shall occur. And I think that causes a lot of problems with probably the economics of the undertaking. The Kānuka, I mean, that was one of the big queries was, you know, how quickly would it grow out here? So we ended up setting up test sites on the property to ensure that everything we were making comment on was factual in terms of the growth rates. And that's what we've achieved. And as I said, coming back to that site after 7 years, and they're up to, you know, 4 metres now, we'll enable that immigration which we're after.
Thank you.
I should go back to that, because the evidence, I may be wrong, I have to look back at my notes, but I thought the evidence that Dr. Rotha Lindsay gave us last week was that it was slower than she had expected.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can't. It's just one of the great mysteries of the modern world.
Probably not.
You emphasised the need for flexibility and any little change will require a variation. I suppose the counterpoint to that is this a function of the fact that notwithstanding the rigorous analysis, you're still going in slow circles with your golf course design about where exactly you're going to put it? In fact, it's not even where exactly, but you've now opened up an entirely new area. So is there, I'm listening to Rachel's question, I think there seems to be some inconsistency here between, as a rigorous analysis, but significant change in the golf course layout, which is the centrepiece of the whole resort.
But I guess it's like anything, when you have time to review what you've done in the past, there's always ways to improve it. For the resource consent, when we had put a stake in the ground, we had to do some, we had a layout we're incredibly comfortable with. But in the passing of time, opportunity to review that the land in question was not part of the original site under offer. So that land has now come up recently, enabling a review of some of the routing we've been doing. Of all the golf projects I've been involved on, it's preferable to have a little bit of river room. Just enables better adaptability and better outcome in the construction of it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Possible. Thank you, sir. Well, good, thanks.
Yeah.
Appreciate your contribution.
In my evidence, I assessed the landscape, visual and natural character effects in detail for each one of the proposed activity areas of the proposed zone. The proposed development within the GSX is confined to the left natural part of the station and confined to the visual catchment within the lower Fernburn Valley shore, including the Glendhu, Park and Stay Lake shore. Within this comparatively small part of the station, the level of existing and consensus development is considerably higher than on the surrounding landscape character areas. In my view, the submitted approach to consolidate development in this confined lower-lying part of the wider landscape near the lakeshore with extensive protective covenanting of the wider landscape is preferable to a more widespread form of development. The proposal will provide for a range of recreational and tourism opportunities in a special landscape. The activities will be located in appropriate parts of the proposed GSX where they can create a sense of place associated with the existing development. This includes an area to add to the adjacent popular camping activities in an area where it is visually associated with the existing campground on the Glendhu Bay Lakeshore. The planned complementary rural and artisan activities associated with the farm homestead will build on the character of the existing node of development and will read as a coherent cluster of buildings. The golf course and associated buildings, such as the clubhouse, will become the features of Park and Stay without changing the character already expected under the consented golf resort. Should a proposed consenting process, including the application of design assessment methods now proposed, the residential accommodation will be in character with the consented individually sited home sites in the various parts of the landscape that was suitably landscaped around as proposed or suited to affording the site of change. I concluded that the proposed development would not cause inappropriate visual or amenity effects on the Glendhu Park and Stay landscape in comparison to what has been consented by the Environment Board due to an amended rule framework that would provide sufficient control over any future development within the activity areas. Natural character effects are avoided by the provision of sufficient setbacks from the lake and streams. Comment on Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence. In the following section, I provide comments on Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence as it relates to landscape matters and Dr. Reed's landscape rebuttal, evidence for council. I note that Dr. Reed supports a number of changes to the proposal and then it will be hindsight. I understand that Dr. Reed has some concerns in relation to the height of the proposed buildings, including the 8 additional home sites. Mr. Ferguson outlines the changes in building height, which would only amount to 2.2 metres to the consensus design to the top of the roof. While I hadn't re-examined the visibility of each individual building since the consent was granted, I consider that when considered in the setting of 50 consistently designed and landscaped units, such a small change would be visually barely discernible when viewed from public viewpoints, such that adverse visual effects would be avoided. In addition, I have assessed the 8 additional home sites on site in detail and made some recommendations in relation to the micrositing. The submitter has developed detailed designs for the building platform on each of these 8 home sites, which include choice of appropriate RLs, earth mounding, and specific planting and retention of existing native vegetation to ensure that at most only very small parts of the building, less than the top meter, will be visible from any of the viewpoints along the road between the Fernburn Bridge and the Glenloo Bluff. Appendices 1 and 2 show the mapping of the zone of visual influence on an overview map for the overall development and for the 8 home sites with detailed maps. These maps show the mapping of visibility based on detailed terrain data with 0.25 metre contours within the development area, supporting viewpoints located along Mounted Spiral Road between the Fernburn Bridge and Glenloo Bluff. The range of visibility are colour-coded and indicate which viewpoints provide views to specific areas. And I'll read all of it and then we can go through.
Yes, please do that. I was going to ask you at the end to go take us through your diagrams.
Yeah, but you want me to finish?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Appendix 3 contains a table that provides details on the potential visibility of 3.8 metre high buildings to be erected on the building platform identified in the detailed maps at the specified RLs, consistent with the modelling undertaken in 2008. A detailed design has been developed for the 8 additional home sites as shown on the attached plans. The location of the proposed building platforms, as well as earth mounding and planting, is shown at 1 metre contour intervals, illustrating the potential to reduce visibility to very low levels for these home sites, with the proposed positioning of home sites and mitigation mounding and shaping. Appendix 3 contains a table with detailed information about the extent of potential visibility of the 8 proposed home sites, based on the terrain modelling and proposed planting. Based on this detailed information and site-specific design, I consider this level of visibility appropriate and in line with potential visibility of the other consensus home sites. In my view, this detailed site analysis and micro-siting will ensure that inappropriate adverse effects over and above the effect of the consensus development can be avoided. The introduction of an additional 8 home sites in the context of the overall development will, in my opinion, not introduce a high level of domestication in this part of the landscape, given that the mitigation measures in the form of planting were originally designed for the overall development of 50 residential sites. It should be noted that the ecological enhancement planting and screening vegetation was developed for the originally proposed sites, and none of the planting areas subsequently withdrawn when 8 sites were not further pursued. The consensus development will introduce a higher level of domestication within this contained part of the landscape than is currently found, and I consider that the additional 8 home sites would be in character with this development in terms of their location, siting and mitigation measures. The building design forms an important aspect of the overall visual effect of the residential dwelling, and I'm in support of the introduction of assessment methods as outlined in Mr. Ferguson's supplementary evidence. This will, in my view, help to ensure that the overall amenity of the development is maintained through a consistent design standard while allowing for some site-specific variation of buildings. Lecture activity area. in relation to the setbacks within the nature activity area, Mr. Ferguson provides clarification that a 20 metre fixed marginal strip of ground land and 3 metre boundary setback will result in an overall 23 metre setback from the lake edge. Consider this an appropriate setback distance to maintain the natural character values of the lake, and visual effects would be similar to the consensus clubhouse, which had the same setback distance. Open space farm activity area. Mr. Ferguson outlines a potential alternative approach to the management of the large bulk of the open space farm activity areas, which could be managed as a rural zone. While the management as rural zone would, in my view, lead to a similar level of landscape protection in the area, I concur with his findings in this respect. The extension of G activity area over the Thurnburn near the Moraine slope will visually integrate the stream and adjacent terraces in the overall golf course zone. I anticipate that this would not lead to a significant change in the landscape character or visual amenity of the area, given that it is currently in pastoral use. Conclusion. In my evidence, I assess the visual amenity, landscape and natural character effects of all proposed activity areas and provided an overall assessment of cumulative effects of the entire GSF. I have reviewed the proposed GSET activity areas and associated provisions in light of the amendments outlined in the supplementary evidence provided by Mr. Ferguson. Concluded that the proposed development within the GSET is confined to less natural parts of the station, where it is visually confined within the lower Thurnburn Valley floor. Within this comparatively small part of the station, the level of existing and consensus development is considerably higher than in the surrounding landscape character areas. In light of this development, within confined nodes located in a much broader district-wide ONL, I consider that appropriate landscape outcomes can be achieved through the activities proposed in each of the activity areas. The proposed comprehensive regeneration and revegetation programs would, in my view, enhance the overall visual amenity associated with the proposed use management and development within the new space zone. So would you like me to go through the attached plans?
Please.
So appendix 1, that's showing a zone of visual influence mapping. So this has been prepared by Derby Partners, but I don't know the process of how these things are being prepared. So there are 14 viewpoints between the bridge across the Thurnburn and Glenburn Bluff, and they're colour-coded, so starting on the Thurnburn end, they're green, they're moving into blue colours and purple to red. And as you can see, the rays that radiate out from each of these viewpoints where they hit the terrain, they're shown as this colour. So it's an area is shown as green, that means that's an area that's visible from viewpoint 1 or 2 or 3, whereas blue would be the, you know, visible from the central section and red towards the last section. So that's an overall view of the development in my appendix 1. And I've provided the kind of technical data and on the plan. Derby Partners have provided the technical data, how it has been prepared. I'm happy to answer any specific questions about that. In Appendix 2, that's assumed in version of that Appendix 1, and it shows each one of those 8 home sites in more detail. And I think it's worth giving you a bit of the background of how we've worked through this development. So the 8 home sites, there was an originally proposed location, and that's shown for each one of those. That's the kind of orange colour outlined. We've worked together to find the best possible location for the home site and the best RL to reduce the visibility as much as possible while still enabling access from the driveways and things like that. So in addition to the existing terrain, there's also some proposed mounting, and that's shown with the contour data around each one of those home sites. And the rays that extend towards the home site, that's the rays from these viewpoints. So you can 16 that details how the proposed mounding blocks out the views for each one of the home sites. So that's to the terrain only, that's not including the building.
I was going to say, that doesn't show the, obviously the aspect that's the top of the roof or...
That's right. Yeah. And that's because, if you imagine it in plan view, the building would be, it's a vertical line, and the line is set that way, so you can't actually demonstrate it on the same plan.
Yep.
So that's why we have attached. And I'm happy to go through each one of the eight if you would like to.
I think we've got the idea of what you of
yeah.
what you're talking about.
Yeah.
In this
so
one.
If you're happy to answer the questions about that. But in response to Mr. McLeod's comments, that's why we also prepared this table in Appendix 3, which now outlines in detail the visibility of the actual houses that we would put onto the home site. And so that has been, the same modelling has been undertaken in 2008 for the original home site, and you can see that I was in the red row, and then underneath you can see in the green row the modelling on the currently proposed home site of the current RL with the shaping as proposed on the plans in Appendix 2. And so, as you can see in the red line, there are some sites that where you know visible when it says up to 2.5 meters, for example, it means the top 2.5 meters of the building were visible, and we've been reducing these as much as we could by lowering the RL and providing the shaping and the vegetation around it to have them less than a metre within all areas. So, also happy to give specific questions to those buildings in the building.
When you mean to say lower the RL, basically, you're digging out the foundation before you put anything on top of it.
Yeah, so you have a lower, you know, RL basically, you're digging out the foundation before you put anything on top of it. Yeah, although, I mean, if having been out and having looked at some of the currently built home sites, so this is why you can go, because you've got the tech levels of the roads, the access roads, and there's a distance of the building to the access road, so you can't go down too much, otherwise your driveway becomes sort of steep, the section of feasible access, the building's anymore, so it's a bit of a trade-off of how close you can get to an access road and how low you can go with the building platform. So that was the fact that we want to buy questions to see that, looking like just number two,
It appears to be a 3 metre drop from the access road to the house, 308, maybe 2 metres, maybe it's... Yeah, so it's the 308
that's a little mound right next to the driveway, so it would be the...
Yeah, it would be just about 307,
yes, so that's correct. So that, that was part of the reason why we had to move from the orange location, the originally contented. We had to move it out just a little bit further so you can actually get the driveway in around the corner there.
Also, just for clarity, the width in the hatching, is that the distance from the viewpoint? Well, largely the width, the more distance, does that make sense?
I don't know. I have to ask.
Well, this we're going to have to come and see. You've got time for it.
I'm not sure about that. So normally you can't actually see it, but if you're slow through them, yeah, there's a difference.
So we'll adjourn. We're back at 3:45.